Morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to 10AP 1952, State versus Brian K. Avery. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General Thomas Balistrieri. Mr. Balistrieri.
In every contested proceeding, whether it's a court proceeding or whether it's a sporting event, there are rules governing how the contest should be conducted, what one party should do, what the other party should do, and what are the consequences if one or the other of those parties does not comply with the rules. Now, let's take football, for instance. In football, I don't usually like sports analysis. I'm not a real sports fan, but this one's good.
You got 2 minutes.
In football, there's a rule that when a forward pass is thrown and the offensive player catches it and has sole possession, then it's considered a completed pass, and the offensive team is credited with the yardage that's covered by the pass. If the defensive player catches it and has sole possession, that's called an interception, and the defensive team then gets possession of the ball. If both the offensive player and the defensive player have equal possession, then the rule is that possession goes to the offensive player. Now, we had an unfortunate situation a couple of weeks ago when the Green Bay Packers were playing the Seattle Seahawks. And there was an offensive pass thrown up. And it was thrown into the end zone. And the Green Bay Packer defensive player clearly had possession of that football. The offensive player from the Seattle Seahawks had his hand on it, but he did not have possession.
That's your story.
That's the videotape.
Those are the facts.
As a matter of fact, I was just reading yesterday, Madam Chief Justice, that the official who made the call has admitted he was wrong.
Okay. So the official in this case,
are court judges and justices. Now, what the official in the Green Bay Packer game did was to say, well, under the rules, the defensive player had the ball. It should have been an interception, but the offensive player had his hand on it. Under the rules, he did not have possession. He should not have been credited with a catch, but he had his hand on the ball, so we'll give him the catch anyway. We'll give the Seahawks the touchdown. We'll give him the game.
Well, is there a reversal in the interest of justice in the game?
I think that the analogy here is that in interest of justice cases, that is often what courts do. We have rules on when a defendant is entitled to a new trial on the basis of newly discovered evidence. But in some cases, courts have said, we're going to ignore those rules. Under those rules, the defendant doesn't get a new trial. But we're going to ignore the rules, and we're going to give him a new trial anyway.
I would phrase it somewhat differently. I would just say that there's another rule that trumps the other rules. Not that there's no rule. It's your position, then, interest of justice is no rule.
That is exactly our position.
I know. Well, the other position is that it is a rule. And a rule that has meaning.
Well, if it does, I have never seen a case from either this court or the Court of Appeals that explains just what that meaning is. You, the courts, not just this court, but the courts of this state have spoken in these vague generalities about exceptional cases. Well, what is an exceptional case?
You know it when you see it, counsel.
That's obscenity. The rule that we propose is that when a defendant seeks a new trial on the basis of newly discovered evidence, and the defendant doesn't meet the test for newly discovered evidence, he is not entitled to a new trial on the basis of newly discovered evidence, the court should not overrule that position and give him a new trial anyway, even though under the rules he is not entitled to a new trial.
Okay, so what's the rule on discovered evidence because it wasn't in existence at the time of the trial but unknown to him? Is that your definition of why it's not?
It would not matter. Well, under newly discovered evidence, you have to meet the test for, under the newly discovered evidence test, it has to be evidence that was unknown to the defendant at the time of the trial. Under the interest of justice test.
Just a minute. Does it also have to be in existence at the time of the trial under the test you propose for newly discovered evidence?
No, it does not have to be in existence at the time.
Okay, so if we didn't have photogrammetry at the time he was tried, then couldn't be in existence at the time. And he certainly wouldn't know about it if we didn't have it, correct? So why isn't it newly discovered evidence then?
Yeah, we're not saying that the photogrammetry evidence in this case doesn't meet some of those first four standards for newly discovered evidence.
Well, my question to you is simple. Is the photogrammetry evidence newly discovered evidence under the test you expect us to employ?
It is under the first four parts of the test, which define when evidence is newly discovered. It does not meet the fifth test for newly discovered evidence, and that is whether the result of the trial would be different if this evidence was introduced.
That's not what Plude says. Plude says there's a new trial for newly discovered evidence, five parts. Evidence discovered after conviction, we agree on that, right?
We agree on that one, yes.
Then it was not negligent in seeking the evidence.
No problem there.
The evidence is material to an issue in the case. Agree
on that.
I think
it is, yeah.
Identity. The evidence is not merely cumulative.
Definitely not cumulative.
Okay. Then Flood says, which is a little different than you said, Mr. Ballastieri, if the defendant is able to prove all four of these criteria, then it must be determined whether a reasonable probability exists that had the jury heard the newly discovered evidence, it would have had a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt. Now, do you accept that test?
Yes.
You do?
Sure.
Is that outcome determinative in your opinion?
In my opinion, it should be. It should be considered to be outcome determinative.
So what does the, in your opinion, what does the trial court or court of appeals or Supreme Court have to determine to meet, let's call it the fifth test of a motion for a new trial?
The court would have to determine that a jury, looking at both the old evidence that was introduced at the trial and the new evidence, would have...
Could, but would...
There's a reasonable probability.
A jury looking at the old evidence and new evidence
would have a reasonable doubt about the defendant's guilt. Now, we say it's outcome determinative for two reasons. One is who's doing the looking, and it's helpful to contrast the newly discovered evidence situation from the ineffective assistance of counsel situation, because the tests are similar, but there's actually a significant difference. In the newly discovered evidence test, the eyes, so to speak, that are looking at the old and the new evidence are the eyes of a hypothetical new jury. We're looking at this from the perspective of how a jury would view the old evidence and the new evidence. In the ineffective assistance of counsel situation, we're looking at it from the perspective of the court. We don't throw a new jury in here. The question is whether the court has substantial doubts about whether the result of the old trial was reliable. And that's the second difference between ineffective assistance and newly discovered evidence. And that is, in the ineffective assistance context, you're looking at the result of the old trial. You're looking at it to see if the result of the old trial was reliable. But in the newly discovered evidence test, it's not the reliability of the old trial that's at issue. It's the result of a new trial with the new evidence. You're looking at the outcome. And that's why it's our position that under the newly discovered evidence test, the test is outcome determinative.
Now, the Strickland test, which is the ineffective assistance,
right,
is a test of prejudice, right?
Well, prejudice is a component of it, yes.
Mm-hmm. So is it the Chapman test in Strickland?
The Chapman test?
Yeah.
No, but the Chapman test is a harmless error test.
That's right.
Which is different from the prejudice test.
Mm-hmm.
From, well, starting with the fact that in the prejudice situation, it's the defendant that has the burden of proof, and under the Chapman harmless error test, it's the state.
I know, but is the test different for the state and the defendant?
Yes, and because of the standard of proof. Under the harmless error test, the state has to prove the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Under the Strickland test, the defendant only has to prove that the error undermined confidence in the result. That's a substantially lesser standard of proof than under the harmless error test.
So the error undermined confidence in the result.
Counsel, did Judge Brennan get it right in her dissent, as far as you're concerned, or is there something that she missed?
I believe she got it basically right. I mean, I think that her analysis was essentially correct in that, she basically said that she liked the dissent in a couple of cases like Armstrong, where this court took the position that even if evidence did not meet the test for newly discovered evidence, you could still reverse in the interest of justice. Justice Brennan took issue with that position, as does the state in this appeal.
Can you take issue with that particular question? You framed the question for this court with the word should. Should a court exercise its discretion?
And that was a very carefully chosen word.
Sure, I understand that. And should is different than can.
It is very,
shall.
Yes.
Should means to me, let's see if it means the same to you. Should means to me, I won't tell you, I was going to imitate my grandmother, but I won't do that. Should, in her German voice. Should means to me that, you know, that it's best if you not do it. Doesn't mean you can't do it. You're not prohibited from doing it. But let me advise you, it's best if you don't. So if that's what you are arguing, how can you advance that it is error as a matter of law to do what perhaps you're saying you shouldn't?
Well, I can't. The reason I use the word should as opposed to can't is because you have taken the position that you have the power to do this. And
that's right. Do you expect us to give away that power here today?
I expect you not to exercise
that's it. That's right. But you're not saying here that we don't have that power.
I am not saying that. I am saying that you do have that power, but I am saying that you should not be exercising it unless you can come up with an explanation that I have never seen in any case why a case is so exceptional that evidence that would not change the result of the trial should nevertheless undermine the verdict, undermine the judgment of the first trial, and give the defendant a new trial that's going to wind up with exactly the same result. Why is that case exceptional? I don't know, and I've never seen an answer to why that kind of case is exceptional.
Fair point, I think, but my concern is this, that should is simply directive, and we can't, as a matter of law, find error under the should language, under directive, you know. So how can you expect a reversal of the Court of Appeals with a should inquiry?
The reason I expect a reversal is because the Court of Appeals never explained in this case just why this case is so exceptional that it could ignore the rules for granting a new trial in the interest of justice and grant a new trial anyway.
Okay, let me ask one further question on this. If they had offered explanation as to why they think this is so special and so unique, then you would be having no argument under that issue. Is that correct?
My answer to that is, I have thought about this for a long time, and frankly, I cannot conceive of a situation where evidence that would not change the result of the trial would make the case so exceptional that we have to reverse a judgment, we have to undo a trial, give a defendant a new trial that's going to result in exactly the same thing as the first trial. It just doesn't work.
You're just saying you dastn't do that. That's what you're saying.
I'm saying,
but you're not saying you can't.
Let me phrase it a little more specifically and a little more in legalistic terms. Theoretically, the court has the power to do this. I'm not saying you don't. I would get nowhere with that. I mean, I'm a practical guy. I know what I think I can get this court to decide and what I know I can't get this court to decide. Now, I know I can't get the court to decide that. I know I can't get this court to say you don't have the power. But by saying the court should not exercise that power, I am absolutely confident that in practical effect, as opposed to theory, in practical effect, that means a court should never reverse a trial in the interest of justice on the basis of evidence that wouldn't change the result because, as a matter of logic, as a matter of law, no reasonable person could find that that kind of evidence creates an exceptional case. Now, taking it one step further, getting back to the test for newly discovered evidence, the test for newly discovered evidence and juxtaposed to granting a new trial in the interest of justice, one of the things that the court can consider in granting a new trial in the interest of justice is whether the real controversy has not been fully tried. Well, just like with my argument on exceptional cases, I don't know how a court could ever say that a controversy was not fully tried because of the absence of evidence that made absolutely no difference in the result. What is there about evidence that has no impact on the result that prevents the case from being fully tried? I am at a loss to understand what there is about that evidence.
Mr. Balestrieri, your whole argument then depends on the court adopting an outcome determinative test, because your outcome determinative test determines newly discovered evidence, and it also determines interest of justice. So if you lose on that, both arguments fail.
I don't think so.
Well, let me just finish this.
Okay.
Your outcome determinative test, I don't buy into, because I think what you're doing is saying that the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals or the trial court sits as the jury or the trial judge on the case and decides the case anew, figuring out all of the evidence and says, heck, heck, he's guilty. And I don't know that that's the job of any of the courts on review.
Well, I absolutely agree with you. That's not the job of a court on review. What the job of a court on review is, because of the nature of the newly discovered evidence test, which is to determine whether the result of the proceeding, whether there's a reasonable probability that the result of the proceeding would be different, the job of the judge, whether it's the circuit judge, court of appeals judge, or the justices on this court, you have to make a predictive determination, not how you would decide the case, but you have to be able to predict how a jury would decide this case, given the old evidence and the new evidence. Mm-hmm. That's the nature of the test.
That may be the nature of the test, but you don't know the jury. You assume a reasonable jury is what you would do, because you're reasonable. Therefore, the reasonable jury would do what you're doing.
You
would
assume that.
You have to assume that.
Yes.
So once you assume that, then you get to where I say the judge is making the decision. Because it has to be predictive of what a reasonable jury would do, and the judge becomes the reasonable jury, by definition.
No, I don't think the judge becomes the reasonable jury. The judge just makes a determination of what somebody out here, this reasonable jury, would do. It's not the judge's determination.
No, but
it's
that
not it's not the determination of how I, the judge, would decide this case on the new evidence. It's this predictive determination of how a reasonable jury would decide it. Now, that, you know, it may be difficult to separate them.
It's a legal fiction.
But you want to call it a legal fiction, that's fine. But that's nevertheless the test. It's not the judge's determination. It's how the judge thinks the jury would determine it. And that is a legally different test. It's a legally different standard. We're not putting the judge in the jury box.
How do you win if we don't accept outcome determinative test?
I think the argument on the newly discovered evidence test works either way, whether the test for newly discovered evidence is outcome determinative or whether it's a question of just having some question about the reliability of the result. The point here is that under the test for reversal in the interest of justice, on the grounds that the real controversy was not fully tried, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference whether you say that the real controversy was fully tried, absent evidence that made no difference in the result, or if you say the real controversy was fully tried because we don't have any problem with the result, because we maintain confidence in the result. It's the same thing. How can you say that the case was not fully tried if you have full confidence in the result of the trial? You can't. It's not logically possible.
Counsel, if you should not prevail and it would go back for a new trial, does the Daubert rule apply?
No, the Daubert rule is prospective, only applies to cases that were commenced after the date of the legislation.
And so the new trial would not be a case commenced after the date of
it's the date the case was commenced. This case was commenced like in 95.
Just asking.
So, okay. Yeah. So Daubert would not apply in a new trial here.
Now you have a case here, if I understand it, where it's a question of identification.
That's the basic issue, right?
And what you have are a number of witnesses who identify the defendant.
Yeah, I wish we could say that there are a number of witnesses.
Okay.
There are a couple of witnesses.
Okay, a couple of witnesses who identify. Whether it's strong identification or weaker identification, they do identify. And then you had a number of witnesses who are alibi witnesses, right?
Well, that's where Avery and I differ quite considerably.
That's why I'm asking the question.
He presented those witnesses as alibi witnesses. Under our view of the evidence, there was no alibi.
Mm-hmm.
He had plenty of time.
Yeah, that would be a dispute between
right.
your witnesses and them. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So you think it's a strong case against Mr. Avery at the trial court?
I think there was a strong case when this case was tried, yeah. Whether there would be, whether the state could put on a strong case 17 years later is a whole other question. Which is why I stress throughout my brief the need for finality. That is because it's very difficult to retry a case 17 years later.
And where's Mr. Avery now?
He's in prison. Which one I don't know, but he's in prison. All right, our red light's on. Thank you.
Thank you. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. Keith Finley, representing Brian K. Avery.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Finley.
Initially, let me introduce my co-counsel, Tricia Bushnell, who's with me at counsel table, and I also have to correct one thing by way of introduction. Also, Mr. Avery is not in prison. Mr. Avery is sitting right here with me in court today. I also want to just say one brief word. You may be puzzling why the courtroom is so filled here today. We don't have a high school.
If you would speak a little slowly.
I certainly will. Thank you. We have also with us today quite a few law students, some of whom have worked on this case, but also many who have studied the case in class and so are here for a wonderful educational opportunity that the court is providing to us. So we thank you for that. Now, we're here today.
I think that assumes a fact, not yet in evidence. We'll see.
We're hoping. We're here today in this case because the state lost in the Court of Appeals. And so the state now wants to change the rules that this court has repeatedly and recently affirmed, and to change those rules in a way that drastically reduces the power of this court and the Court of Appeals to ensure that justice is done in individual cases. Now, I have never used a football or sports analogy in any legal argument that I can think of, but I have to seize this one because I think it is such an interesting one under these circumstances. As Mr. Balistrieri says, there are rules in any contest. And the point, though, of the interest of justice authority is that sometimes when you follow those procedural rules, you get the wrong result. And that's what happened in that Green Bay Packers game. The referee, the jury, made the wrong call, got it wrong. They reviewed it through the appropriate appellate procedure, through the instant replay, and they applying the rules that govern that process, they had to say, we defer to the fact finder in the court. But we all knew it was wrong. Now, in sports, we can live with that. But in criminal
You're
cases...
You're not doing it pleasantly.
We can live with it very unhappily.
Okay, that's
But
better.
In real life, where we're talking about a potentially innocent man, and I would say an innocent man going to prison, we cannot live with that. That's why we have the interest of justice authority, to allow courts to look at this and say, maybe you did it all right, but we still are too uncomfortable with the outcome to let it stand. We need to do it again so that we don't make a grievous error of justice. Now, the Court of Appeals, of course...
Counsel?
Yes.
You
don't
think that every time someone or a new technology develops that someone gets a new trial, right?
Of course not.
So what is your limit?
Under which? Under the interest of justice or under the newly
Both.
Discovered?
Both. Tell me when it's... Because anyone could always argue, right? You could always argue, gosh, this evidence wasn't available then. And if it were, then maybe the jury would have thought this, or maybe the jury would have thought that. Tell me where you cabin this, where it stops. Because
you know, you do need finality.
Yes.
You need fair trials, but you also need finality, and we have limited resources. Can't try every case several times, and witnesses die, evidence is gone. And tell me where you cabin your argument.
Sure. And, of course, you're absolutely right. Finality is important, but as this court has also recognized many times, fairness is vitally important, and getting it right is vitally important. What I would say is that, no, not every advance, not every little piece of new evidence that may come along warrants a new trial. We have, and we have protections against that in both the interest of justice standard and the newly discovered evidence standard. We have the five-part test that Mr. Balestrieri was talking about. And so we're not going to grant a new trial in the interest of justice unless the evidence is of such significance in the case that it's reasonably probable that a jury would find a different outcome. By the same token, while we're not constrained, as this court has put it on many occasions, by those mechanistic requirements of a statute like that, by the same token, in the interest of justice analysis, we essentially accept and give to the reviewing courts the responsibility to appropriately exercise their discretion. But it's not standardless. I think the Chief Justice is absolutely right. There are rules. But the rule is one that deliberately gives the court a great deal of discretion. The rules are these. The court can grant a new trial in the interest of justice under two circumstances. When for any reason justice has miscarried, or alternatively, when the real controversy was not fully tried. And to give added substance to that, Mr. Balestrieri sort of poo-poos this, but what the court has instructed itself and the lower courts to do is to say we don't apply that except in exceptional circumstances. And so to do this, the court has to have a profound sense that there's something wrong here. And that's what the Court of Appeals in this instance did. Mr. Balestrieri is trying to fix a problem that doesn't exist. I have complete confidence in this court and in the appellate courts, in their ability to exercise their discretion responsibly and not willy-nilly overturn convictions, and I think the empirical record confirms that. As the data we provided to the court shows, that over the last 3 years, this claim, out of what, tens of thousands of cases litigated in this state, the claim has been raised 160-some times, and courts have granted new trials in the interest of justice 11 times, and they've granted it in criminal cases 8 times. That is not a problem that needs fixing. That tells me that standard, that exceptional case requirement is being adhered to. Mr. Ed Balestrieri's response to that in his brief is that 8 times is too many. Well, that again is what he's echoed here today to say, well, you actually have the authority, but you should never exercise it. Well, that's tantamount to saying you shouldn't have the authority. That is contrary to the purposes of the rule and what it's all about.
Mr. Finley, it seems to me the way you're arguing the case is the court has two ways it can reach the result you want.
Yes.
One is to argue that this meets the five-part test under newly discovered evidence. And that the state and you seem to agree that you've met the first four, and there's a difference of opinion whether you met the fifth.
That's right.
And there's a difference of opinion as to how to state the fifth prong of the newly evidence test.
Perhaps. There might be. I'm not entirely sure what Mr. Balestrieri is saying about that, but maybe, yes.
Okay. Well, then, so I'm going to ask you, one, to state your understanding of the test the court applies to newly discovered evidence, the fifth test. Second part of my question is, under the interests of justice, under the manifest injustice prong, which is not at issue here, you get into the concept of what a new trial would bring.
Yes.
And the result. But under the fully tried test, which is at issue here, you don't reach that issue.
That's right.
If it's not fully tried, it goes back. You don't have to say it'd be a different result, there wouldn't be a different result. It just wasn't fully tried, and it goes back. Now, as I understood Mr. Balestrieri, he really, in effect, began to merge these two because he wants the test of is it going to be outcome determinative put into the interest of justice test, saying how could you have an interest of justice if you're not going to have a different result? So I want to know, what is your test that the court should, that you want this court to say is the fifth test on a newly discovered evidence? Now, is that the Plude test?
Yes.
All right. If the defendant is able to prove all four of the criteria, it must be determined whether a reasonable probability exists that had the jury heard the newly discovered evidence, it would have reasonable doubt as to the guilt.
Yes.
Doesn't mean it would have changed the verdict to me. Do you read it as changing the verdict?
Well, the court does not have to find that it would change the verdict, but rather that there's a reasonable probability that a jury would have reasonable doubt. And that, of course, would mean changing the verdict if a jury has reasonable doubt. But it's not an assessment in the first instance that I, the judge, think the outcome will be different, because we leave that to the jury to decide that. My test is nothing more than the test that this, on both interest of justice and newly discovered evidence, is nothing more than the test that this court and the lower courts have articulated repeatedly for decades.
Which is?
Which is, that, and, if you, and my test is Plude, and it's McCallum, and it is that the court's task under in the newly discovered evidence context is to look at the old evidence, look at the new evidence, and decide whether there is a reasonable probability that a jury, considering the new evidence and the old evidence, would have a reasonable doubt. It is not the court's job then in that circumstance to let me back up. McCallum makes it clear that there's actually several steps in that process. Part of that analysis is to decide whether the new evidence or the new witness is credible. Okay? But it's a very limited credibility assessment. It's not the court's role to decide, do I believe this witness or not? Do I believe this evidence or not? The court makes it very clear that's the jury's task. Rather, the credibility assessment is much more limited, and the court's task is only to determine whether the evidence is within the realm of believability. That is to say, essentially, whether it's incredible as a matter of law or whether it's something a jury could believe. That's it. That's what this court has said is the extent of the court's role in assessing credibility. Once the court, and of course if the court finds that it's incredible, then it could not have it to make a difference on the outcome. But once it does decide that it's not incredible in that sense, then the court's task is simply to look at, well, what's the significance of this evidence? How significant is it in terms of the entire picture of this case? So we might have a case, for example, where the new evidence relates to one small piece in a circumstantial link of inferences. And the court can say, well, the jury might find this to be believable, but it's of such insignificance in the evidentiary picture in this case that it wouldn't create a reasonable probability of a different result. It's an entirely different matter, though, when you have evidence of the type in this case, which is not about some circumstantial link in the inferential chain or about mere impeachment of a witness, but it goes to the central question in the case, identity. Because in this case, if the credible evidence that's presented by the experts in this case, measuring Mr. Avery as being inches too tall to be the perpetrator, and if the jury believes that, or even is troubled by that if they don't fully believe it, that is dispositive of the case. It is conclusive. If the jury believes it, case over. This is what the case is about. So the court's role is to assess the significance of the evidence in the evidentiary picture, but not to decide for itself whether to credit that evidence or whether on how that evidence would be balanced against other evidence in the case, but simply to say if it's that important, if it's evidence of that significance, that it would make it, that it would, and it's indisputable that if you believe this testimony, that he's too, that Mr. Avery's too tall, he cannot be the guy. Then the court's job is done. A new trial. We leave that for the jury to decide whether or not to actually credit that testimony, or even if it doesn't credit it, to at least put enough stock into it to have reasonable doubt about whether he could be the perpetrator. Now, as to the interest of justice claim, Mr. Balistrieri says he cannot conceive of a case in which you would have new evidence that's not important enough to warrant a new trial based on newly discovered evidence, but yet would meet the interest of justice standard. Well, I want to tell you, that's not what this court has said. This court has on numerous occasions found interest of justice, granted interest of justice relief based on newly discovered evidence, beginning with Armstrong, and even Justice Ziegler herself, I don't mean to pick on you, but I just want to say, Justice Ziegler, you make the point beautifully. And you make the point beautifully in your concurring opinion in Plude, where Justice Ziegler finds, I don't think he's met the newly discovered evidence standard here. But I nonetheless would concur and grant relief because I think he's entitled to a new trial, in the interest of justice.
Counselor, I don't think the majority of the court, analyzed the evidence in Armstrong as newly discovered evidence. They did it in the interest of justice, but they didn't go through a newly discovered evidence analysis there. Am I wrong?
No. I think you're absolutely right. I don't mean to be misheard to say they analyzed it. My point about Armstrong and subsequently unanimously reaffirmed in Maloney and then Justice Ziegler's concurrence in Plude, my point is there that what Mr. Balistrieri is saying is that if you have evidence that could be raised as newly discovered evidence, then you have to meet the newly discovered evidence standards, and you cannot grant relief in the interest of justice separately. And what I'm pointing out is that in Armstrong, the court did.
You're right.
That's not the tack the court took. And then in Maloney, the court specifically said, we have the authority to grant a new trial in the interest of justice based on new evidence. And that was a unanimous opinion in that case. So what Mr. Balistrieri is asking you to do is to overturn numerous opinions of this court, decades of opinions from this court and the lower courts. I mean, we have the State versus Garcia versus State that goes back to, what, the 60s, maybe 70s? In which this court granted a new trial in the interest of justice.
Counselor, if you prevail on your arguments under newly discovered evidence, then the court doesn't need to get to the interest of justice, correct?
You're exactly right.
Okay, so you're asking us to first look at the newly discovered evidence and to disagree with opposing counsel and find that, in fact, it does satisfy all of the Plude tests, and so Mr. Avery should get a new trial based on that. But if the court then agrees with the state on the newly discovered evidence, we should nevertheless go forward in the interest of justice, correct?
Yes, and actually my position...
What is the test that you want us to apply for the interest of justice? What are the factors that the court should be looking at part?
I'm sorry. You have to keep in mind what the posture of this case is right now. And that is, I'm not asking you to invoke your interest of justice authority in the first instance. The Court of Appeals did that. This case is on review of the Court of Appeals, right? So all I'm asking you to do is look at it and say, the Court of Appeals found that the interest of justice requires a new trial. The standard of review for that judgment is to review it for an erroneous exercise of discretion. And there's no way to find an erroneous exercise of discretion here when you have such critical evidence that goes to the central issue of the case that this jury never heard. That's why the state doesn't even argue in its brief that there was an erroneous exercise of discretion under the interest of justice standard, instead recognizing that they cannot get over that insurmountable standard of review. They try to strip the appellate courts of the authority to even consider interest of justice relief in collateral proceedings. Yet, again, to get there, the court would have to overturn decades of authority. If I can just point out, for example, just 2 years ago in State versus Henley, the court made it very clear that the appellate courts do indeed have interest of justice authority in collateral proceedings. In that case, of course, as you probably well remember, the court ruled that circuit courts do not have interest of justice authority for freestanding claims of interest of justice in collateral proceedings. But the court then said, but we as an appellate court do have that authority, both statutory and appellate, In a freestanding claim, in collateral proceedings, we choose not to grant a trial on that basis, but we have that authority. You'd have to go back. The state is asking you to reverse course abruptly and overrule your own precedent from 2 years ago, the same precedent that was affirmed again in State versus Maloney, previous to that in 2006, and in Armstrong in 2005. We have the unanimous court repeatedly saying this authority does exist in collateral proceedings.
Counsel, I just want to clarify something.
Yes.
You were asked by Justice Robinsack whether the approach has to be, first, you have to do motion for a new trial, and only if the defense loses on that does it then go to the interest of justice. And I wonder if that's accurate.
I think that's one way the court could go.
That's right. Fine.
The other way the court could go is to address the interest of justice first.
Only. Yeah.
And in fact, that is probably the simplest way to resolve this, because the case law is so well established that the court has the authority to do this in collateral proceedings based on new evidence, and because once you recognize the court has that authority, the standard of review answers the question.
That's why I wanted to correct that, because I didn't want to, it didn't seem to me your answer that you have to do it in that order was correct.
The court did not mean to suggest you have to do it in that order.
You may do it. The court may do it in that order, but the court can reach right into the was not fully tried new trial.
That's right.
Under IOJ.
Because remember, the Court of Appeals reversed on both grounds, so you only need to affirm on one or the other. Which way you do it makes no difference, but if you affirm on one, you need not address the other, and therefore, if you grant a new trial, if you affirm the Court of Appeals decision granting a new trial in the interest of justice, you need not even wade into all of these thorny issues about how exactly the newly discovered evidence standard is applied and whatnot.
Could I ask, in post-conviction proceedings, in this one in particular, we have two expert witnesses.
Yes.
And I understood from what you said that the judge is entitled to a limited credibility assessment within the realm of believability. But I assume that that applies to the defendant's expert. How is the court, in your view, supposed to assess the state's expert?
I think the court assesses the state's expert in the same way, in the sense of making an initial credibility determination. And in this case, the court looked at both and found neither of them to be incredible. In fact, keep in mind, these are both highly qualified experts, well-trained, applying what is a very well-validated science that is used all the time by prosecutors to identify people and determine the heights of people and objects in images. So what the court then didn't find either of them incredible, but what the court then did was went and said, but I'm a little more persuaded by the state's experts, which is interesting in itself, because keep in mind, if you look at how they measured the suspect, both of them measured the suspect as inches too short to be Mr. Avery. The only thing the state's expert said was, but I can't be 100% sure. I can't completely rule out 6'3", Mr. Avery's height. So even if, one way to look at it, even without the defense expert, we've got a powerful case of innocence here based on the state's measurements. But to get more directly to your question, the court's role then in considering the state's expert would be to look at it and say, if the state's expert came in and demonstrated that, in fact, the defense expert was essentially a fraud, a fly-by-night, a quack, or that pointed out that he had made demonstrable measurement errors that could be exposed, and the court therefore found that the defense expert was no longer credible, then the state's expert would trump, assuming that he said that he actually found that he measured the perpetrator as being the same height as Mr. Avery, then that could trump the defense experts. But when the court finds them both credible and finds that they are in almost total agreement but disagree on one little point about whether their results are definitive or just essentially probably true, then to go that next step and say a jury can't consider this, that is to overstep the court's role and to engage in that improper weighing of the evidence that our system reserves for juries.
I ask you one other question. You're asking for a new trial?
I'm asking you to affirm the Court of Appeals order for a new trial.
In view of the fact that Mr. Avery is sitting here in the courtroom, and in view of the argument that the last trial was 17 years ago, why would you want a new trial? I mean, what is the likelihood that there would be a new trial?
Well, I want a new trial because it was, we believe, an unjust conviction of an innocent man, and he should not be straddled with that for the rest of his life. He has a very significant interest in this. Would there be a new trial? I certainly hope not. I certainly hope not because he's an innocent man and because there's powerful new evidence that I would hope that a prosecutor, upon reexamining this case to go forward to retrial, would say, you know what? I don't have a case here. But if the prosecution wants to try him again, they can. I'm asking for a new trial because that's the remedy that's available to me. If I could ask you to come in and just declare him innocent and wipe the case clean, I'd ask you for that. But that's not the remedy that's available. The remedy that's available is to set aside the conviction and grant a new trial. It can be tried. Is it difficult to retry a case 17 years later? Sure it is. But we have trials. It's not unheard of by any means to have trials that lead to convictions decades after a crime. And remember, this trial would have the benefit of having an existing record of the first trial. So we're not going to be in a position of asking witnesses to come in and look at Mr. Avery sitting in the courtroom and say, do you recognize him as the perpetrator? Those in-court identifications are highly suggestive, highly tainted procedures that really aren't that probative. What's probative is the out-of-court identifications. Those were done 17 years ago. That's still there. That evidence is still coming in. Even if the witness isn't available, it's admissible testimony. So the state isn't losing the substance of any of its evidence. If it really wants to retry Mr. Avery, go at it. I don't think you'll succeed because I think the new photogrammetry evidence is so powerful from both the state and the defense that it simply cannot be him, that they won't succeed. But that's the state's call.
Mr. Finley, if there's going to be a new trial, as you're asking for, why should it be on both counts?
It should be on both counts because because this case is one case. Two incidents, but one case.
The evidence only goes, the photometric evidence, the analysis, only goes to one of the counts, doesn't it?
That is exactly correct. And that's because the video on the second robbery was, the angles and the quality of the video was not susceptible, was not amenable to photogrammetry analysis. But you have to look at how this case was tried. It was a joint trial. The evidence against Mr. Avery was statements that were intermingled. The statements applied to both crimes. The police officers who testified in several instances in the jury trial transcript, they said it was the same individuals who committed both crimes. The same four guys committed the Malone's Fine Foods on the first evening. The same four guys the next day joined by a fifth guy. And so it was all tried together. The evidence against Mr. Avery in one was used to incriminate him in the other one as well. It was to the state's theory was Mr. Avery was involved with the same guys in both crimes. If it wasn't Mr. Avery, then logically, if it wasn't Mr. Avery in the Malone's Fine Foods robbery, then logically, by the state's own theory, it wasn't him in the second one either. The jury has to be able to consider this evidence in considering whether he committed either of them because they were said to be the same people involved in two, in basically a mini crime spree over a period of 2 days. And if I may, that's precisely why I think the state has never suggested before in these proceedings until its brief in this court that if you reverse on one, you shouldn't reverse on the other. It never crossed anybody's mind before the case got to this court because it was so patently clear to everyone involved that these cases rise and fall together.
The Court of Appeals said a trial court is to determine only whether there is reasonable probability that the new credible testimony would create a reasonable doubt as to the defendant's guilt, citing Edmonds. It is not the function of the trial court in a motion for a new trial to weigh competing credible evidence. Is that the standard you advocate?
Yes, that is the standard the court did indeed set forth in Edmonds, and Edmonds relied on McCallum, this court's decision in State versus McCallum, for precisely that proposition. And that is the settled law.
And what about Love that said the court wasn't going to determine outcome determinative or another standard?
That gets to a slightly different question, and that is when we determine whether the jury might have reasonable doubt, the question is, do we have to determine that to a more likely than not level, or do we have to determine it to something less than that? And my position is twofold on that. One, just like this court didn't have to resolve it in Love, or the Court of Appeals in Edmonds, or in this, or in the court below here, you don't have to resolve that either, because regardless of which it is, Mr. Avery's new evidence meets that standard. But if you want to look at that question, let me clarify, if I can, what exactly that question is. The question is, by outcome determinative, what the cases take that to mean is, does the evidence establish the likelihood of a different outcome by a level that meets a more likely than not standard? The alternative to that is something lesser than that. And that's what is often referred to as the undermines confidence standard. That is to say, we don't know if it meets that, if it's more likely than not, but we're troubled enough by it that we no longer have confidence in the outcome. And if you do resolve this question, I see my red light is on. May I finish this?
Yes, ma'am.
If you do resolve this question, my position is that what the standard we use in this state is a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And that is a legal term of art. In every instance in which the courts speak of a reasonable probability of a different outcome, they say that is not an outcome determinative standard. That is an undermines confidence standard. We say that in ineffective assistance of counsel cases under Strickland. We say it in Brady versus Maryland cases. And we say it even when the prosecution bears the burden of proving a reasonable probability of a crime in a preliminary hearing. In every instance, it means something less than outcome determinative.
Which is one of the points of my questioning, that we're getting so many different standards. You got the Strickland standard, you got prejudicial error standard, maybe in different cases, and can they be summarized into undermining the confidence in the reliability of the verdict?
Yes, I think that is, in fact, a really important thing for this court to do, because if the court is now all of a sudden to say reasonable probability of a different result means something in Strickland and Brady and preliminary hearings, but it means something different here, you're sowing nothing but more confusion. It really makes no sense, because if you think about it, the reason we're worried under Brady and Strickland about whether there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome is because we're concerned that the trial might have gotten it wrong. That same interest is at stake under the interest of justice standard. I'm sorry, the newly discovered evidence standard. That same interest in making sure we didn't get it wrong is at stake. It shouldn't make any difference under which of those vehicles you get to. The court should be satisfied to the same degree that the conviction is sound or not sound. So I think as a matter of simplicity and as a matter of fidelity to the rationale underlying the principles, an undermines confidence standard is the appropriate one to use.
Chief, if I may, until you just started with this tagline, the end here, I thought that I read both counsel really saying the same thing on newly discovered evidence. The first four prongs of the test aren't in dispute. They're met here. And then I see the state arguing that on a motion for new trial because of newly discovered evidence, that the test is whether it is reasonably probable that a different result would be reached at a new trial. Do you disagree with that? Because I heard you saying, using that same kind of language.
As long as that's understood to mean that there's a reasonable probability that a jury would have reasonable doubt, that is, I believe, the standard. And I'm frankly, I'm not sure, I was a little confused, I have to admit, by what the state was actually arguing, because at one point they said, the state argued that it was should be an outcome determinative test. At another point, they cite State versus Dunn for the proposition that the courts have consistently interpreted reasonable probability something less than that. So I think the standard you read me is essentially right as long as you understand that the question is reasonable probability of, that a jury, not the court, but that a jury would have reasonable doubt. But that's a slightly different question than asking then whether but that sort of assumes that we know what reasonable probability means. And I'm arguing that if you reach that, and you don't have to.
Are you saying that we should or should not, or are you agnostic about that?
I'm saying you need not reach that because whatever it means, we've met it. As this court said in Love, and as the Court of Appeals said in Edmonds, it's a very, very fine distinction between undermines confidence and more likely than not. It's a distinction that is rarely going to come into play. This court, as it has said repeatedly in prior occasions, we don't have to resolve it. I think that's true here. All I'm saying is if you do resolve it, the only consistent thing you can say about it, and the only thing you can say about it that is faithful to the purposes of the rule, is that it's an undermines confidence standard.
The state's position, if I understand it, is that a reasonable probability that the new credible testimony would create a reasonable doubt, which is what the Court of Appeals said, which you agree to. Their position is, if it could create a reasonable doubt for the jury, then it's a different result. That's their position, as I understood it.
But the question is, how satisfied do we have to be that it would create that different result? And so do we have to be so satisfied that we think it's more likely than not, or do we have to be satisfied at some lesser to some lesser degree? That's where the squabble on that is about.
Well, the state's position is that the court must affirmatively determine that a jury would probably reach a different result because of the new evidence.
That I disagree with, because they've taken out the adjective reasonable.
Okay.
And if you look at, for example, Kyles versus Whitley by the United States Supreme Court, when they're interpreting the standard reasonable probability of a different result, they explicitly say the adjective matters. It modifies probability, and it modifies it in a way that makes it less onerous.
Thank you, Mr. Finley.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, I have one other question for you. I've never seen an amicus brief like the one that was filed here by Counsel Van Sicklen, who is here, bringing together 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 13 people who can agree on a brief.
It's remarkable.
and from different faculties and different areas of science and the law, challenging the state's expert.
Yes, I think it is remarkable, but what it represents, that agreement that you refer to, reflects the fact that what they're talking about is such a fundamental principle of science, that to have any validity, scientific testing has to be blinded. Otherwise, you have no idea what effect the extraneous information has on the analyst's ability to fairly and objectively analyze what they're looking at. That is such a bedrock principle that it was not a problem to get 13 really prominent scholars in this field to agree on that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ballastreri.
Mr. Ballastreri, for clarification, I want to make sure I understand your argument. I'm looking at the first paragraph of your reply brief. In that first paragraph, you indicate that the state is not arguing the level of proof as more probable than not.
That is absolutely correct.
And you also indicate you are not advancing an argument how convincingly he must prove it. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. And I will point out that doesn't mean we're conceding that issue. We're just not raising it in this case. We are raising it, however, in another case in which a petition for review is pending at State versus Terry Volbrecht. You might recognize the name. That case has gotten quite a bit of publicity over the years. But we have a petition for review pending in the Volbrecht case. Margie Mueller is the attorney from our office who's handling that. And that will be one of the issues that we are asking the court to resolve in the Volbrecht case, and that is, what is the appropriate standard of proof
level
on a newly discovered evidence claim? I mean, the fact of the matter is, it's just a practical consideration here. When I originally wrote this brief, I was way, way over the 11,000-word limit, and I had to do some substantial chopping to get it under the word limit. And there were just so many things we could raise. And we chose not to raise that particular issue in this case, and we are raising it, however, in the Volbrecht case. So we're not raising it here. It's never been briefed by either party. We're not conceding it. We're raising it in Volbrecht. Okay? So maybe you should look forward to that one. That's kind of a prequel to your consideration of that petition in Volbrecht. When it is said in this case that the Court of Appeals made a decision that Mr. Avery should get a new trial in the interest of his, and I have to, by the way, I have to apologize here. My information about where Mr. Avery is was a bit out of date. The latest information I had was that he was still in prison. Obviously, he's not. But when it is said that the Court of Appeals made a decision that Mr. Avery should get a new trial in the interest of justice, that's only correct as a very technical matter. What we had is a situation where two judges said he should get a new trial in the interest of justice, and another judge said, no, he shouldn't get a new trial in the interest of justice. Now, who's right? The two justices who said he should get a new trial, or the judge that said he shouldn't get a new trial?
Does that affect our standard of review, though, Counselor, for the
decision? It should, for this reason. It should for this reason, because the only reason that we can say that the two judges were right in saying he should get a new trial in the interest of justice is because there were two of them.
But isn't that the law? The only reason sometimes you can say that five people on this court are right or four people is because there are four of them. That's what we learn, very first thing we learn, the first day we come here, how to count to four.
Well, hopefully we can say that a decision of four justices on this court is right for more reasons other than that there were just four of you. Hopefully we can say that the decision of the majority is right because under accepted legal standards, your decision or the decision of the majority, the four, comports with those legal standards. We can't say that about the decision of the Court of Appeals in this case, because there are no standards.
Okay, Counselor, I guess my question wasn't very clear, and maybe I'll start again with it. Do you agree with opposing counsel that we review the Court of Appeals decision that we should grant a new trial in the interest of justice as a discretionary decision by that court or de novo by this court?
It's under the rules, under the precedent of this court, it's a discretionary decision, and it's reviewed for erroneous exercise of discretion.
All right.
That's what we have a problem with.
Now, that standard doesn't change if there are two judges on the Court of Appeals that make the decision rather than three, does it?
The standard doesn't change.
Okay.
But right. What we are saying is that standard is inherently problematic, because ordinarily when you review a decision for erroneous exercise of discretion, like sentencing cases, for example, there's a whole body of law that says this is what a judge is supposed to do in order to exercise discretion. And you look at what the judge did, you compare it to that body of law, and you say, does that discretionary decision comport with that body of law? In this situation, you can't do that because there is no body of law. There is no standard. And that's what we're asking the court to do, is to put some standards into that interest of justice rubric so that we can have decisions that we can review in
And we can say the court was right, not just because there were two of them, but because the decision comported with these standards. Thank you very much for your attention.
What's your citation to a case that says we review the Court of Appeals on a discretionary standard?
I didn't actually cite any because I'm not saying that you should review the Court of Appeals decision under the discretionary standard. I don't want you to do that. I want you to say, as a matter of law, that since this evidence did not warrant a new trial under the newly discovered evidence test, the interest of justice test should never have been applied in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Attorney Ballastrieri, and thank you, Attorney Finley, for your argument in yet another case on newly discovered evidence and the interplay of the newly discovered evidence rule and the interest of justice discretionary reversal rule. That completes our argument in 10-18-1952, State versus Brian K. Avery. We will take a few minutes recess before we hear our second case, so people who wish to leave may do so, and those who wish to enter may come in. We are in recess.